Hi, this is David. This episode is part two of a two-part story. And if you haven't listened to part one yet, I would advise you to do that if you want this episode to make sense. Also, if you value this podcast, there are several things you can do to support it. You can spread the word about it by recommending it to two people you know who you think might like it. You can give it a five-star review wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're not the kind of person who reviews things online, I can only say that I used to be that kind of person too. And then I realized that one of the reasons the internet is such a half-wits paradise is that tasteful people like you and me have left too much of the reviewing to the imbecile community. So I would urge you to start rating and reviewing things online, starting with this podcast. Aside from that, the best way of keeping me in podcasting is to make a small donation to this podcast via PayPal, which you can do by following the link on my website, which is www.ghostsofdallas.net. In the previous episode of this podcast, I told the basic story of the Odeo incident, and I explained why it remains one of the most stubborn, unsolved mysteries of the Kennedy case. 2 months before Kennedy's assassination, a young Cuban-American woman named Sylvia Odeo was visited by three anti-Castro activists at her apartment in Dallas. She later swore that one of these men was Lee Harvey Oswald. Her sister Annie saw this man as well, and she too always maintained that it was Oswald. But the Oswald who turned up at Sylvia Odeo's apartment differed from the real Oswald in a few interesting ways. The real Oswald was a fanatical admirer of Fidel Castro, but the man who visited Sylvia Odeo's apartment claimed to be a committed enemy of Castro. He also claimed to be a committed hater of President Kennedy. Indeed, he told one of the two men who were with him that Castro's enemies should have had the guts to shoot Kennedy after the failure of the Bay of Pigs operation. If Sylvia Odeo's story was true, it's a real wild card in the assassination story. It puts Oswald in the company of two unknown men just 2 months before Kennedy's assassination. And the possibility that he conspired with these men becomes impossible to rule out. And as I showed in the previous episode, Sylvia Odeo's story is very hard to disbelieve. Both the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee on Assassinations found her to be a highly credible witness. They didn't doubt that she was visited by three mysterious men in Dallas, and they didn't doubt that she genuinely believed that one of them was Oswald. Even some of the most hardened anti-conspiratorial writers about this case have admitted that Sylvia Odeo's story does have an uncanny ring of truth about it. The man who came to her apartment looked like Oswald and talked like him and behaved in ways that were strikingly consistent with secret habits of Oswald's that Sylvia Odeo couldn't possibly have known about when she told her story for the first time. My own feeling is that Sylvia Odeo's story is compelling in the literal sense of that word. It's not that I especially want to believe it, it's just that it's so creepily detailed and plausible that I find it hard not to believe it. I think we're obliged to accept that Oswald did go to Sylvia Odeo's apartment, unless we can find even more compelling evidence that proves he couldn't have. In fact, I think we should hope like hell that Sylvia Odeo did encounter the real Oswald at her apartment, because that would be the simplest way of explaining how she got so many spooky little details about him right. If it turns out that the man on her doorstep couldn't have been Oswald, that's not going to make Sylvia Odeo's story go away. It's only going to leave us with the even bigger problem of having to explain why a man who looked exactly like Lee Harvey Oswald and knew an uncanny amount about his beliefs and his behaviour patterns was going around posing as Oswald just a couple of months before the Kennedy assassination. So in this episode, we're going to look at the other side of the Odeo argument. We're going to look at all the evidence which suggests that Oswald just couldn't have been present at Sylvia Odio's apartment when she said he was. The first thing to say about the case against Sylvia Odio's story is that it does seem to be very impressive, at least from a distance. In fact, there are many sensible commentators who believe that the case against the Odio incident is impregnable. They believe that Oswald was hundreds of miles away from Dallas when the Odio incident supposedly occurred. The Warren Commission believed this, or at least that's what it said it believed in its final report. Sylvia Odio claimed that Oswald's visit occurred sometime during the last week of September 1963, although she was never sure of which particular day. The Warren Commission established that there were only two nights in that last week of September when it was even remotely possible that Oswald had been present in Dallas. Those nights were Tuesday the 24th of September and Wednesday the 25th. All the other nights that week were out because the commission had irrefutable proof that Oswald was in New Orleans on Monday night and that he embarked on a six-day trip to Mexico City early on the Thursday morning. This left Tuesday and Wednesday as the only nights that were even vaguely in play for the Odio incident. And after the commission established that point, it then seemed to offer clinching proof that Tuesday and Wednesday were off the table too. It piled up brick after brick of evidence that seemed to wall off even the slightest possibility that Oswald was anywhere near Dallas on either Tuesday or Wednesday. In this episode, we're going to look at those apparent brick walls of evidence, and we're going to check if they're really as solid as the Warren Commission believed them to be. I'm going to start with the second night, the night of Wednesday the 25th, because the evidence about the Wednesday is a lot more straightforward than the evidence about the Tuesday. Before we get started, though, let's remind ourselves of the basic timeline of the week we're talking about. The last week of September 1963 was the week when Oswald and his wife Marina wrapped up their five-month stay in the city of New Orleans. Marina was heavily pregnant at the time, and the plan was that she and their daughter June would move to Dallas to stay with Marina's friend Ruth Payne, and Marina would have her baby there. Meanwhile, Oswald would head off to Mexico City, and he would visit the Cuban embassy and try to get a visa as part of his half-baked plan to start a new life in Cuba. On the morning of Monday the 23rd, Ruth Payne drove Marina and June off to Dallas in her station wagon. Oswald himself lingered in New Orleans for at least another day, and maybe for two, and we know for sure that early on the afternoon of Thursday the 26th, he entered Mexico on a bus. Earlier that day, he'd been seen on another bus, which was on its way to the Texan border town of Laredo. Other passengers on that bus remembered seeing Oswald at around dawn and engaging him in conversation. This bus to Laredo had departed from Houston at 2:35 a.m. on Thursday morning, and although nobody recalled seeing Oswald actually get on board the bus in Houston, it's a fair bet that he did. But how had Oswald got from New Orleans to Houston? The Warren Commission believed that Oswald had taken a Continental Trailways bus from New Orleans at 12:20 on Wednesday afternoon, which had got into Houston at 10:50 that night, and that he had then spent the next 4 hours in Houston before boarding the bus to Laredo. If Oswald did catch that bus from New Orleans to Houston, that would eliminate the possibility that the Odio incident happened on Wednesday night. Houston is 3.5 hours south of Dallas by car, and Oswald could hardly have been on Sylvia Odio's doorstep in Dallas at 9 p.m. on Wednesday if he was on board a bus from New Orleans to Houston that didn't get into Houston until 10:50 that night. As I said in the previous episode, though, the Warren Commission's belief that Oswald was on board that bus was nothing more than an assumption based on the fact that Oswald had to have got from New Orleans to Houston somehow. The commission was never able to find any other passenger on that bus who recalled seeing Oswald on it, and neither of the drivers who'd driven the bus recalled seeing Oswald on it either. This gap in the record seems significant because the commission was able to find witnesses who'd seen Oswald on every other bus leg of his journey from the US to Mexico and back to Dallas. Some commentators have argued that because the commission searched so diligently for evidence that Oswald was on this bus from New Orleans to Houston and never ended up finding any evidence, that amounts to evidence of a kind that he wasn't on that bus. I tend to agree with that position, but even if you don't, the bottom line is that it's nothing more than a guess to say that Oswald was on that bus. In fact, there were no verified sightings of Oswald at all on Wednesday the 25th. There's a big black hole in his Wednesday schedule, and one way of filling that black hole is to imagine that the Odeo incident happened that night. Maybe Oswald left New Orleans in a car with the two mysterious Cubans. The drive to Dallas would have taken them about 8 hours, so as long as they left New Orleans by 1 p.m, they could have arrived on Sylvia Odeo's doorstep when she said they did, at 9 o'clock. And then, after leaving her apartment that night, Oswald's friends could have driven him south to Houston. That drive would have taken them about 3.5 hours, so Oswald would easily have been in Houston in time to catch the Trailways bus to Laredo at 2:35 a.m. But there is one quite chunky piece of evidence that stands in the way of this scenario, and that is the apparent fact that Oswald made a local phone call in Houston on Wednesday at around the same time of night when the Odeo incident supposedly occurred in Dallas. I briefly mentioned this phone call last time, and we need to take a closer look at it now. It's known in the assassination literature as the Twyford phone call, because the man Oswald was trying to contact was a Houston socialist named Horace Twyford. To tell the story of the Twyford phone call properly, we need to go back to the afternoon of Kennedy's assassination. When the police and the FBI searched Oswald's apartment in Dallas that afternoon, they found his address book among his personal effects. Over the next few weeks, FBI agents tracked down all the people who were listed in that address book, and they grilled them about their connections to Oswald. One of the people who had the bad luck to be listed in Oswald's address book was Horace Twyford. Twyford was a merchant seaman who lived in Houston. He was a member of the American Socialist Labor Party, and he served as the party's local representative in Houston. Part of his role involved mailing out copies of the party's newspaper, which was called the Weekly People, to local lefties in Texas and Louisiana. He'd sent at least one copy of this paper to Oswald in New Orleans. The envelope had had Twyford's name and address on it, and that was how his name and address had come to be in Oswald's notebook. Of course, the FBI didn't know any of this to start with, so they had to eliminate the possibility that Twyford had some kind of more sinister connection to Oswald. On the 2nd of December 1963, the FBI knocked on Horace Twyford's door in Houston. Twyford was away at sea at the time. The door was answered by his wife Estelle. When the FBI men asked Estelle Twyford if she knew how her husband's name and address had come to be in the notebook of the president's assassin, she initially told them that she had no idea. She said she knew nothing about Oswald except what she'd read in the papers and seen on TV. But she soon admitted that she did have other information, although she wanted to consult her lawyer before she said anything more. Her lawyer advised Mrs. Twyford to tell the FBI what was on her mind, so she did. She told them that one night not long before the Kennedy assassination, she'd answered a telephone call from Lee Harvey Oswald. Oswald had asked to speak to her husband, but on that occasion too, her husband had been away at sea. When Mrs. Twyford told Oswald that, he briefly explained to her why he was calling. He said that he was a member of the Fair Play for Cuba committee, and that he was curious about a copy of the Weekly People that he'd recently received in the mail from her husband. Oswald was wondering how Horace Twyford had got hold of his name and his postal address. Oswald also told Mrs. Twyford that he was about to fly to Mexico and that he'd been hoping to spend the next few hours discussing ideas with her husband. Oswald didn't specifically tell Mrs. Twyford that he was calling from the Houston area, but his remark about hoping to talk with her husband before leaving for Mexico does make more sense if we assume that Oswald was in Houston at the time. Maybe it even suggested that if Horace Twyford had been at home, Oswald would have liked to pop round to talk to him in person. Mrs. Twyford also told the FBI that she didn't remember the phone call being connected by an operator, which gives us another firm-seeming reason to believe that Oswald was in Houston when he made the call. But when did he make the call? When the FBI first put that question to Estelle Twyford, she said she believed the conversation had taken place in late October, or possibly even in early November. But when Horace Twyford got back from sea, the FBI interviewed him as well, and he claimed to have a better idea of when the phone call had happened. He recalled that his wife had mentioned the phone call to him during a quick trip that he'd made back to Houston on Friday the 27th of September. He'd also been at home the previous weekend, and he didn't believe that his wife had mentioned the phone call to him then. So Horace Twyford reckoned that the call must have happened during the week ending Friday the 27th. If the call was indeed a local call, the natural conclusion to reach is that Oswald rang Mrs. Twyford up on the night of Wednesday the 25th, when he was waiting around in Houston to catch the 2:35 a.m. bus to Laredo. And if he did make a local phone call in Houston that night, he obviously couldn't have been 240 miles away in Dallas at the same time. The Twyford phone call is a pretty daunting piece of evidence then. Some commentators believe that it completely cock-blocks any possibility that the audio incident happened on Wednesday night. But I say not so fast. For a start, we have to remember that this was just a phone call. Mrs. Twyford didn't actually see Oswald in Houston with her own two eyes. In fact, Oswald didn't even specifically tell her that he was in Houston. Mrs. Twyford only had the impression that he was because she didn't remember an operator connecting the call, and also because of Oswald's remark that he'd been hoping to spend the next few hours talking with her husband. But on that second point, we have to remember that Oswald was a chronic liar who frequently told lies just for the hell of it. And we know that he told Mrs. Twyford at least one big lie during their phone conversation. He told her that he was about to fly to Mexico, and we know for a fact that he didn't do that. So it's quite possible that some of the other things Oswald said during this phone call were also lies. From the moment it became clear to him that he wasn't going to get to speak to Horace Twyford, Oswald's original reason for making the phone call, whatever that reason was kaput. It's possible that he did ring up for the reasons he mentioned to Mrs. Twyford, but it's also possible that some or all of what he said to her was an improvised fiction, including the bit about how he was leaving for Mexico that night and had been hoping to spend the next few hours speaking with her husband. This remark of Oswald's is the best and perhaps the only reason why people believe that the Twyford phone call happened on the Wednesday night. But if the remark was a lie, the phone call could easily have occurred on some other night altogether. Maybe Mrs. Twyford was right when she said in her first FBI interview that the phone call had happened not in late September, but in late October or early November. And maybe she was wrong when she recalled that there had been no operator involved in connecting the call. When you look at the cold facts, the Twyford phone call doesn't preclude the possibility that Oswald was in Dallas on Wednesday night, because it's not out of the question that Oswald rang up Mrs. Twyford on a different night altogether from some place other than Houston. Maybe he made the call from New Orleans before he even left for Texas, or maybe he made it from Dallas after he'd returned to the United States from Mexico. You might think that I'm clutching at straws here and that the evidence clearly shows that Oswald made the call from the Houston area on Wednesday night. You might even think that I'm talking like a conspiracy theorist when I doubt that. But the fact is that there's something very hinky about the Twyford phone call. It's a big square peg and it just can't be made to fit neatly into any of the available holes in Oswald's schedule. So either Estelle Twyford's story must have been incorrect in some way, or else we need to rethink our general picture of Oswald's movements that week to fit the phone call in. Because it's important to note that the Twyford call doesn't fit neatly into the official version of Oswald's movements that night either. Remember that the Warren Commission believed Oswald got into Houston that night on a bus from New Orleans, and that bus didn't get into Houston until 10:50 p.m. This meant that the commission had to believe that Oswald had made his local phone call to Mrs. Twyford at some time after 10:50 p.m. So really, it was the Warren Commission that had to clutch at straws to believe that the phone call happened that night. It verged on the absurd to suggest that Oswald would have rung up a complete stranger at 11 p.m. to talk about socialism for a few hours and perhaps even to pop round to the complete stranger's house in person. Surely even Oswald wouldn't have been clueless enough to pull a move like that. And if he had, Mrs. Twyford surely would have remembered such a gauche fact. And yet when she was interviewed by the FBI, Mrs. Twyford explicitly rejected the idea that Oswald could have called her that late. In fact, here's what the original FBI record of Mrs. Twyford's interview says about this point. Quote, Mrs. Twyford stated that she feels sure this telephone call was received after dark, but not in the late evening. She stated that if this call had been received at 10 p.m. or 11 p.m, she would have considered this fact unusual and believes that she would have recalled it. Mrs. Twyford stated the best she could do toward fixing the hour of this call was to estimate that it was received in the period between 7 p.m. and 9 p.m. It was a bit of a stretch for the Warren Commission to claim that this estimate of Mrs. Twyford's was off the mark by at least a couple of hours, and perhaps by as many as 4 hours. And if you read the Warren report, you'll see that the commission made a fairly cheeky attempt to get around this problem by suggesting that Oswald might have made his phone call sometime earlier that evening when the bus had made a stop on the way to Houston. The report says, quote, the call may have been made from Beaumont or some other stop on the route. It was pretty audacious of the Warren report's authors to suggest this, because although the FBI had told the commission that the bus made a stop in the town of Beaumont, Texas at 8:15 p.m., it had also told the commission that, quote, at Beaumont, Texas, the stop is only long enough for the transfer of drivers. So it was quite the Hail Mary for the Warren Commission to suggest that Oswald might have called Mrs. Twyford during this exceedingly brief bus stop. And the authors of the report obviously knew that, because they were honest enough to add, quote, however, in view of the bus schedule, the call was probably made in Houston later than Mrs. Twyford remembers. So the Warren Commission's attempt to shoehorn the Twyford phone call into its Wednesday night schedule was pretty unconvincing, to say the least. This brings me back to a point I made in the previous episode. Generally speaking, I think the Warren Commission's investigation was excellent. The Commission's conclusions were nearly always rational and plausible, and thoroughly backed up by the evidence. You almost never catch the Warren Commission swimming against the tide of common sense. That's why I generally accept the Warren Commission's findings. And if the Commission had been able to construct a coherent, unforced timeline which showed us that Oswald was clearly somewhere else at the time of the Odeo incident, I would have no problem accepting that timeline. But the Commission was conspicuously unable to do that. Its attempts to account for Oswald's movements that week were a dog's breakfast. This is particularly true of the Commission's timeline for Wednesday. First, the Commission put Oswald on a bus that no witness saw him on, and then it had him telephoning a complete stranger for a chinwag at 11 p.m, despite the fact that the woman who took the call explicitly said that it happened between 7 and 9 p.m. It was very unlike the Warren Commission to flounder this badly. And this uncharacteristic floundering makes me believe that the Commission's timeline for that Wednesday night was just fundamentally wrong. Something else happened that night that the Commission never got to grips with. And obviously, the main candidate for what happened was the Odeo incident. As for the Twyford phone call, the bottom line is that Mrs. Twyford herself never swore that it happened on the Wednesday, and she certainly didn't verify with her own two eyes that Oswald was in Houston when he made the call. Whereas Sylvia Odeo swore up and down that she did see Oswald in Dallas, and so did her sister Annie. So if I had to choose between believing the testimony of the Odeo sisters and believing that Oswald made a local phone call in Houston on Wednesday night, I would easily believe the testimony of the Odeo sisters. That said, though, we don't necessarily have to choose between the stories of Estelle Twyford and Sylvia Odeo, because there's another scenario that lets us believe that both their stories were true. Maybe the Odeo incident happened on the Tuesday night. Maybe Oswald and his two Andy Castro buddies drove from New Orleans to Dallas on the Tuesday afternoon and turned up at Sylvia Odeo's apartment at 9 p.m. that night. And then the next day, Oswald either got a bus to Houston or was driven there by his shadowy friends. The drive from Dallas to Houston only takes 3.5 hours, so whether he got there by bus or car, Oswald could have been comfortably ensconced in Houston by the early evening, and he would have had plenty of time to kill there before his bus left for Mexico at 2:35 the next morning. In that situation, it would have made perfect sense for him to look up Horace Twyford in the local phone book to see if he was available to shoot the breeze for a few hours. And Oswald could easily have made that call at some time between 7 and 9 p.m., precisely as Estelle Twyford said he did. There's a lot about this scenario that feels right. It means that we can believe both Sylvia Odeo's story and Estelle Twyford's story without having to shave off any inconvenient details to make them fit. And that's why there are some pretty reliable commentators on the Kennedy case who believe that the Odeo incident possibly or even probably did happen on the Tuesday night. Vincent Bugliosi leans towards the Tuesday night scenario in his book Reclaiming History, and so does Jean Davidson in her book Oswald's Game. For the Warren Commission, on the other hand, the Tuesday night scenario was never seriously on the table, or at least that's the impression you get from reading the Warren Report. The Commission seemed to think that it had several pieces of rock-hard evidence which showed that Oswald was still in New Orleans on Tuesday night and Wednesday morning. The Warren Report gives you the impression that the only night that was ever even half in play for the Odeo incident was Wednesday night, and that night was ruled out by the Commission's belief that Oswald was on that bus from New Orleans to Houston at the time. To approach the Tuesday night question realistically, we need to admit that the Warren Report does present some pretty impressive evidence suggesting that Oswald didn't leave New Orleans until Wednesday morning. That evidence may not quite be impregnable, as the Warren Commission believed, but it's certainly a lot stronger than Bugliosi and Davidson make out in their books. Bugliosi in particular is quite cavalier about the Tuesday night evidence. He casually suggests that the Odeo incident might well have occurred on Tuesday, but he makes no serious attempt to prove it. This is quite unlike Bugliosi because he rarely touches on any issue about the Kennedy case without taking an incredibly deep dive into all the relevant evidence. But I think there's an interesting reason why Bugliosi and Jean Davidson don't bother to mount any serious assault on the Tuesday night evidence. Both these writers tend to believe that Oswald did go to Sylvia Odeo's apartment, and because they tend to believe that, they're open to the possibility that he went there on Tuesday night. But neither of them positively needs to prove that the Odeo incident happened on Tuesday night, or indeed that it happened at all, because believing that the Odeo incident occurred is not essential to their bottom line verdict on the Kennedy assassination. For Bugliosi and Davidson, the bottom line is that Oswald killed Kennedy and that he almost certainly acted alone. That's what I believe as well. And when you believe this, you can either take the Odeo incident or leave it. It's not an essential component of the lone assassin case. If Oswald did visit Sylvia Odeo's apartment while posing as an anti-Castro fanatic, that would add some interesting colour and nuance to the lone assassin story, but it wouldn't fundamentally change that story. And strangely enough, the Odeo incident is not an essential component of the conspiracy theorist's case either. Conspiracy theorists certainly like to talk about Sylvia Odeo's story, and they like to believe that it's at least partly true, but for them, it's not essential to believe that the man on Odeo's doorstep was the real Oswald. In fact, it's more exciting for them to believe that he wasn't Oswald, because that would mean that the man was an imposter who was part of an elaborate premeditated plot to set Oswald up as the fall guy. So conspiracy theorists, too, have never really needed to roll up their sleeves and prove that it was physically possible for Oswald to have been at Sylvia Odeo's apartment. Conspiracy theorists are happy with a kind of Schrodinger's cat situation where the guy on Odeo's doorstep may well have been Oswald, but also may well have been an imposter. Either way, conspiracy theorists can use the episode to back up their belief that the official story of the Kennedy assassination is full of spooky little anomalies that just don't add up. So on both sides of the assassination debate then, nobody has ever really had any pressing incentive to prove that Oswald could indeed have been at Sylvia Odeo's apartment. And as a result, this is one of those rare times in the Kennedy case where you find yourself in uncharted territory and maybe even have a chance to say something new. Most aspects of this case have been talked about ad nauseam, but as I've tried to work out whether or not the Odeo incident could have occurred on the Tuesday night, I've found myself in the weird position of being unable to locate the information I need in any of the secondary sources. I've had to rummage through pieces of primary evidence that nobody, as far as I know, has ever rummaged through before. I'm going to save that primary evidence for later, because to start attacking the question of where Oswald was on the night of Tuesday, September the 24th, we need to start with the old evidence, the evidence that made the Warren Commission so sure that he was still in New Orleans that night. Remember here that Marina and June left New Orleans on the Monday morning, and that Oswald was quite certainly in Texas by 2:30 a.m. on Thursday when he boarded the Houston to Laredo bus. The question is, how long did Oswald linger in New Orleans before heading for Texas? The Warren Commission believed that he lingered there until Wednesday, and it believed this partly because it believed that a credible witness had seen Oswald at his New Orleans apartment on Tuesday night. As the Warren report puts it, quote, "A neighbour testified that on the evening of Tuesday, September the 24th, he saw Oswald carrying two pieces of luggage hurriedly leave his Magazine Street apartment and board a bus." The neighbour who said this was named Eric Rogers, and he lived right next door to Oswald. The Warren Commission believed that the Eric Rogers sighting of Oswald matched up very nicely with the testimony of a New Orleans City bus driver who told the FBI that one evening in September, at around that same time of night and at that same location in Magazine Street, he'd picked up a man who was carrying two pieces of luggage. The bus driver couldn't positively identify that man as Oswald, but he said that it could well have been him. And although the bus driver couldn't remember the day or date when he'd picked this man up, he said that it could well have been Tuesday the 24th. According to the bus driver, the man with the suitcases had asked him the way to the Greyhound bus station, and the driver had then dropped him off at the appropriate stop. The Warren Commission concluded that the man the bus driver had picked up on Magazine Street and dropped off near the Greyhound bus station was Lee Harvey Oswald, and that conclusion was not unreasonable. But why would Oswald have hurriedly left his apartment with two suitcases on the evening of Tuesday the 24th and headed for the Greyhound bus station? How did that fit in with the Commission's belief that he didn't leave town until 12:20 the next afternoon on that bus to Houston? Well, the Commission theorised that when Oswald got to the Greyhound bus station on Tuesday night, he checked his bags into a locker, and then he either slept at the bus station or else went back to his empty apartment and spent the night there. Oswald's apartment was furnished, so even though he'd packed his bags and cleared out his stuff, there was still a bed in the apartment for him to sleep in if he wanted to. The Commission also considered the possibility that Oswald had spent that night in a cheap hotel near the bus station, but when FBI agents showed Oswald's photograph to the owners of all the flop houses in that area, none of them recalled having ever rented a room to him. At this point, you may be wondering why on earth Oswald would have even considered sleeping in a cheap hotel or spending the night at the bus station when he had a perfectly good bed back at his apartment. You may also be wondering why he would have wanted to hurry out of the apartment at dusk with his suitcases when he could have departed in a more dignified way the next morning. Well, here is part of the explanation.
And the same station wagon from Texas, the lady that brought him there, came back and they packed the stuff, put it in the station wagon. The station wagon was there for a few days. And I told my husband, I said, they're packing the station wagon. It looks like they're taking everything, so go find out if he's moving.
That is Oswald's landlady, the formidable Mrs. Jessie Garner. Mrs. Garner and her husband owned the apartment that Oswald and Marina rented at 4905 Magazine Street, and they also lived right next door to that apartment, which really cramped Oswald's style, especially given his anti-capitalist habit of not wanting to pay his rent on time. As Oswald prepared to depart from New Orleans, he still owed the Garners 15 days' worth of back rent. The Garners were starting to worry that Oswald was about to skip town without paying his rent. And they were right to worry about that, because that's exactly what Oswald was planning to do. The Garners began to smell a rat on the weekend of September the 21st and 22nd, when they saw Oswald and Marina packing their stuff into Ruth Payne's station wagon. Mr. Garner confronted Oswald on the Sunday morning, and he asked him what he was up to. Oswald assured Mr. Garner that everything was cool. Marina was temporarily leaving town to have her baby, but Oswald himself was staying put.
So he did. He said no, he wasn't moving. He was only sending his wife to Texas to have the baby.
That was a monumental lie, of course. Marina was leaving town for good, and Oswald was planning to bail out too, shortly afterwards. He still had a few loose ends to tie up in New Orleans after Marina left on the Monday morning, but he had good reason to make himself scarce around his apartment so that he wouldn't have any more awkward encounters with the Garners. This would explain why he slipped out of the apartment with his suitcases at nightfall, just as the local bus was coming by, and it would explain why he might well have spent that night at the bus station instead of coming back to the apartment. That part of the Warren Commission's story makes perfect sense. What makes less sense is the Commission's belief that Oswald would have waited until Tuesday night to do that. If I was a cheap and devious little creep like Oswald, and if I was so desperate to avoid my landlords that I was prepared to pack my bags early and spend the night at a bus station, I'd have wanted to pull the trigger on that plan as soon as possible. I'd have cleared out of the apartment on the Monday night, not the Tuesday night. Why would you want to prolong the suspense for a whole extra day? And the fact is that when you look closely at the testimony of Oswald's neighbour, Eric Rogers, you find that Oswald did clear out of his apartment on Monday night. When the Warren Commission said that Rogers saw Oswald leave on the Tuesday night, it made a colossal mistake. The testimony of Eric Rogers was published in Volume 11 of the Commission's hearings and exhibits, and his questioning was handled by the tireless Wesley Liebler. By my count, Eric Rogers told Liebler about six times in six different ways that the night he saw Oswald leave on was the Monday. I'm not going to bore you by quoting all the different ways Rogers said that. I'll put a link to his testimony in the show notes if you're interested in following it up. But to give you just one example, when Liebler asked Rogers if Marina Oswald had left on Monday morning with the woman in the station wagon, Rogers replied, quote, "Yes, then he left that night or late afternoon, went out in a hurry, left all the lights on." To confirm that the Warren Commission misrepresented Eric Rogers' testimony quite badly, I noticed that the Warren Commission attorney Bert Griffin has just published a memoir in which he admits the Commission's mistake. As Griffin writes, quote, "The Warren Commission concluded that Eric Rogers testified that he saw Oswald board a bus on the evening of September 24. However, a close reading of Rogers' testimony would seem to be that Rogers was testifying to the evening of September 23. End quote. I don't think we need to assume that there was anything sinister about the Warren Commission's misrepresentation of Eric Rogers' testimony. I think that this was probably just one of those inevitable blunders that the report's authors made because they were trying to herd together a vast amount of facts under serious time pressure. Eric Rogers wasn't the only neighbour of Oswald's who believed that Oswald cleared out of his apartment on Monday night. Oswald's other next-door neighbours, his landlords the Garners, also believed that he left that night. Mr. Garner never saw Oswald again after he confronted him on the Sunday morning, but he did hear somebody moving around inside Oswald's apartment between 7 and 7:30pm on the Monday evening, which was right around the time that Eric Rogers saw him slip out to the bus with his suitcases. That was the last time that either of the Garners heard any sound from inside Oswald's apartment. Mr. Garner finally let himself into the apartment on the Wednesday and found that Oswald had clearly gone and that the apartment was in a seriously filthy state. The mattress was ruined, the stove and fridge no longer worked, the freezer door had been ripped clean off. When Mrs. Garner testified to the Warren Commission, Wesley Liebler asked her when she thought Oswald had left, and she said, quote, "Well, I figure he left that same night, whatever day that wagon left. I don't think he stayed there that night. I don't think he come back after he left that night. I think he left that night." Liebler then asked Mrs. Garner about those noises that her husband heard from inside Oswald's apartment on the Monday night. Liebler said, quote, "You think the noise he heard was just the noise of Oswald getting his stuff and leaving?" And Mrs. Garner said, "Yes, getting his stuff to get moving." And she added, "Later, I was talking to Mr. Rogers, and he said, yes, he seen him leave about that time that evening. The bus was coming, and he ran out with his suitcase." So the evidence on this point does seem pretty overwhelming. Oswald left his apartment with his suitcases on the Monday evening, and since he didn't spend that night at any of the cheap hotels near the bus station, it's not unreasonable to suspect that he spent the night at the bus station. But if Oswald cleared out of his apartment on Monday night and was never seen in his neighbourhood again after that point, it does start to feel more likely that he left New Orleans on the Tuesday rather than the Wednesday. And at this point, it might be worth mentioning an intriguing little quirk in Sylvia Odio's story that I haven't mentioned before. When she was shown photographs of Oswald by the FBI and the Warren Commission, Sylvia Odio consistently maintained that this was the man she'd seen on her doorstep, but she did throw in an interesting qualification. She said that when she saw Oswald, he hadn't shaved. He looked more whiskery than he looked in his photographs. As she said to the Warren Commission, "The day he came to my house, he had not shaved and he had a kind of a very, I don't know how to express it, but some little hairs like if you haven't shaved, but it is not a thick moustache, but some kind of shadow. That is something I noticed." Oswald also looked kind of drawn, Sylvia Odio said. "His face was kind of drawn." This is the kind of thing I'm talking about when I say that Sylvia Odio's story is full of niggling, unfakeable little details that make it very hard to disbelieve. Because if Oswald packed his bags on Monday and spent that night in a bus station, you can see why he would have looked quite haggard and unshaven to anyone who encountered him on Tuesday night, let alone on Wednesday night. But let's not jump ahead of ourselves, because Oswald wasn't in Dallas yet. Before he could leave New Orleans, he still had to wrap up several important chores. Some of these chores couldn't be done until Tuesday at the earliest. Here are the things he still had to do in New Orleans. He had to show up at the Louisiana Division of Employment Security, and he had to sign there for the unemployment check that would be mailed to him the following week. He had to redirect the mail from his post office box to Ruth Payne's address in Dallas so that Marina would be sure to receive that next check when it was sent. And most importantly, he had to pick up the unemployment check that was on its way to him that week. That check would be worth $33, and Oswald would be needing that money on his trip to Mexico. Now, we know that the drive from New Orleans to Dallas takes 8 hours, and that if Oswald and the two mysterious Cubans were on Sylvia Odio's doorstep at 9 p.m. on Tuesday, they'd have had to leave New Orleans by around 1 p.m. at the latest. So the question we now have to answer is, could Oswald have wrapped up the chores that he needed to do in New Orleans by Tuesday at 1 p.m.? Let's start with his visit to the Louisiana Department of Employment Security. To qualify for his next unemployment check, Oswald had to show up at that office in person, and he had to sign a form in the presence of an official. We know that Oswald did sign this form at some point on the Tuesday, but unfortunately, the time of his visit to the office was not recorded. It could have happened at any time during business hours that day. So this is one New Orleans chore that he might well have wrapped up before 1 p.m. As for the check that Oswald was expecting the next week, that check was mailed to him from the office of the Texas Employment Commission in Austin. It was addressed to Oswald's New Orleans postbox, and we know that the check was collected from Oswald's box that week and that it was cashed at a supermarket not far from his apartment. Strictly speaking, we don't know for sure that the person who collected and cashed the check was Oswald. Nobody saw him pick it up, and the cashier who endorsed the check at the store had no memory of the person who had cashed it. That said, it would be pretty wacky to believe that anyone other than Oswald collected and cashed the check. But when did the check arrive in Oswald's post office box? According to the Warren report, quote, "Under normal procedures, this check would not have reached Oswald's postal box in New Orleans until at least 5 a.m. on Wednesday, September the 25th. The commission's sense of the, quote, normal procedures by which Oswald's check would have got from Austin, Texas, to his post office box in New Orleans was based on an elaborate reconstruction that had been done by the FBI. An official from the Texas Employment Commission had told the FBI that Oswald's check would have been sent from that office by regular mail on Monday the 23rd. At around 5:15 that afternoon, the U.S. Postal Service would have collected the day's mail from the office. When the mail was sorted, Oswald's check would have been put in with the other New Orleans mail, which would then have been loaded onto a truck bound for Houston. In Houston, it would have been put on a train that left for New Orleans at 9:45 on Tuesday morning and got in at around 6 p.m. Early the next morning, the mail from that train would have been dispatched to the relevant branch offices of the New Orleans Post Office. Oswald's P.O. box was located at the Lafayette Street branch of the post office. The staff there came on duty at 5 a.m., and shortly after that they would have started distributing the morning's mail into people's post office boxes. Hence the Warren Commission's claim that under normal procedures, Oswald's check couldn't have got to his post office box before 5 a.m. on Wednesday. If this claim was correct, then Oswald obviously couldn't have been in Dallas on Tuesday night, unless he went all the way back to New Orleans the next day to pick up a $33 check, or unless someone other than Oswald picked up the check and cashed it. Those possibilities are too absurd to bother with, but the FBI's seemingly watertight reconstruction of how Oswald's check got from Austin to New Orleans isn't necessarily as watertight as it seems. Gene Davidson, who wrote the book Oswald's Game, has pointed out that the Bureau's painstaking timeline has got one possible weak link. The whole thing rests on the assumption that the guy from the Texas Employment Commission was correct when he told the FBI that Oswald's check wouldn't have left the office until 5:15 p.m. on Monday. If this guy was wrong, if Oswald's check was mailed from that office earlier in the day, then it's possible that it left Austin on the noon mail train, in which case Oswald would have been able to retrieve the check from his post office box as early as 9 or 10 on the Tuesday morning. You might think, though, that it's a bit presumptuous of Gene Davidson to suggest that the guy in Austin might have been wrong about the time when Oswald's check was mailed. Surely it's fair to assume that the guy knew what he was talking about. But actually, we have several pretty good reasons to doubt that he was right. One of these reasons is located in the Warren Commission testimony of Marina Oswald. Marina told the commission that when she left New Orleans on Monday the 23rd, Oswald told her that he was planning to leave town the next day. That doesn't prove anything by itself, of course, but it does offer us a small hint that Oswald might have been expecting to pick up his unemployment check on the Tuesday, not the Wednesday. Marina dropped an even bigger hint to this effect in an interview she had with a couple of FBI agents just a week after the assassination. She told those agents that when she and Oswald were living in New Orleans, Oswald, quote, went every Tuesday to pick up his unemployment check. Again, you might say that this doesn't prove anything, but it's a pretty hard piece of evidence to ignore. When you're as desperately short of money as Marina Oswald was, you're unlikely to make a mistake about which day your husband normally picks up his unemployment check. And there's one more piece of evidence to throw onto the scales here. In the Warren Report itself, on page 308, we're told that Oswald cashed his previous week's unemployment check on Tuesday, September the 17th, at the Winn-Dixie store near his apartment. It was certainly a bit odd for the commission to report that Oswald cashed that check on a Tuesday and then to say that under normal procedures, Oswald's check for the next week wouldn't have reached him until the Wednesday. So we have three pretty good pieces of evidence here suggesting that Oswald might have at least expected to receive his incoming employment check on the Tuesday, not the Wednesday. And I think there's an additional piece of circumstantial evidence which suggests that Oswald did get his hands on that check on Tuesday. As I've said, one of the other loose ends Oswald had to tie up before leaving New Orleans was to redirect the mail from his post office box to Ruth Payne's address in Dallas. To do that, Oswald had to fill out a standard change of address order, and he then had to either mail that form to the main post office in downtown New Orleans, or else take it there in person. We know that Oswald did one of those two things on or before Wednesday morning, because Oswald's completed change of address form was found in the system later on, and there was a receipt stamp on it, which showed that the form had been received at the main post office on Wednesday at 11 a.m. This receipt stamp didn't prove anything definitive about how Oswald's form had got to the post office, though. One possibility was that he'd taken it there in person, in which case he could have dropped it there as late as 10 a.m. on Wednesday. But he could also have dropped his form into a mailbox anywhere in New Orleans at any time on Tuesday. We know that Oswald's form had a 5-cent postage stamp stuck to it, and that fact does tend to suggest that Oswald dropped the form into a mailbox as opposed to bringing it into the post office in person, because if he delivered the form to the post office in person, he would hardly have wasted a stamp on it. But if Oswald dropped his change of address order into a mailbox on Tuesday, what does that tell us? I think if you look at things from Oswald's point of view, redirecting his mail would surely have been his final priority. It would have been the thing he left for last after he'd done everything else. His highest priority was to get his hands on that $33 check he was waiting for. Oswald needed that money, And given how selfish and devious he was, it must surely have crossed his mind that if he submitted his mail redirection form too early, the post office might activate the redirection before his check arrived, with the horrific consequence that the check might be redirected to Marina in Dallas before he could pick it up. I'll put a link to a photograph of Oswald's completed change of address order in the show notes, and if you look at the box marked effective date, you can see that Oswald put Tuesday's date in there, September the 24th. But would Oswald have risked submitting a change of address order with an effective date of Tuesday the 24th if he was still waiting for a check that supposedly didn't reach his post office box until Wednesday the 25th? My guess is that he wouldn't have submitted his change of address form until he had safely got his hands on the check. And since the 5-cent stamp on the change of address form suggests that he dropped it into a mailbox at some point on Tuesday, I think we have one more reason here to suspect that Oswald did collect his check on Tuesday. But when did Oswald cash the check? This is the final piece of the New Orleans puzzle we have to deal with. And here is what the Warren Commission had to say on this question. Quote, "Sometime between 4 p.m. on Tuesday, September 24th and 1 p.m. on Wednesday, September the 25th, Oswald cashed an unemployment compensation check at a store in New Orleans." The store the report was talking about there is the Winn-Dixie supermarket near Oswald's apartment, which is where he'd cashed most of his previous unemployment checks, including the one that the commission said he cashed the previous Tuesday. Unfortunately, when Oswald cashed his final unemployment check at the Winn-Dixie store, nobody wrote a date next to the endorsement. So there's no record on the check itself of exactly when Oswald cashed it. So what was it that made the Warren Commission believe that he cashed it sometime between 4 p.m. on Tuesday and 1 p.m. on Wednesday? The authors of the Warren report don't make it very easy for you to work out the answer to that question. They offer you a footnote that mentions two FBI documents. In one of those documents, you discover that when Oswald cashed his check at the store, it was endorsed with the initials of a cashier named Thelma Fisher, who finished her Wednesday shift at 1 p.m. So that's why the commission believed that Oswald cashed his final check before 1 o'clock on Wednesday. But what made the commission believe that he'd cashed the check no earlier than 4 p.m. on Tuesday? This is obviously a crucial question, and yet neither of the documents mentioned in the footnote gives you any clue what the answer is. And I don't know of any book about the assassination that answers this question either. But I think I can claim to have solved this little mystery myself. There's an enormous trove of FBI documents about the Kennedy assassination that's available online these days, and as I was slogging through those documents, I came across a memo that was sent from the FBI's New Orleans office on December the 11th, 1963. This memo is signed by an agent named Donald L. Hughes, and it explains that at 4 p.m. every afternoon, the Winn-Dixie store in Magazine Street was in the habit of clearing out its cash registers so that all the cash and checks received since 4 p.m. the previous day could be added up and prepared for deposit at the bank on the following morning. According to Agent Hughes's investigations, Oswald's $33 check was among the takings that the Winn-Dixie store deposited at the bank on Thursday, September the 26th. This meant that Oswald must have cashed it sometime between 4 p.m. on Tuesday and 4 p.m. on Wednesday. If he'd cashed it before 4 p.m. on Tuesday, it would have been part of the bank deposit made on Wednesday the 25th. My first thought when I read Agent Hughes's memo was that this document finally sounds the death knell for the idea that the ODO incident could have happened on Tuesday night. All the other evidence seems to permit the Tuesday night scenario or even to point to it, but if the check that Oswald cashed at the Winn-Dixie store couldn't have been cashed before 4 o'clock on Tuesday, then it's game over for the idea that he was in Dallas at 9 o'clock that night. You can't do an 8-hour drive in 5 hours. The mathematics of it just don't work. So that was my first thought when I read Agent Hughes's memo. But as anybody who has studied this case in any detail will know, the question that always faces you is, at what point do you stop digging through the evidence? If the evidence tells you something you don't want to hear, do you accept that verdict or do you keep digging? These days, the temptation to keep digging is harder to resist than ever because of that almost infinite trove of declassified government documents about the case that's available online. Some of these documents are raw, unsorted FBI files. There's thousands of pages worth of them, and they're not indexed or paginated. They've just been dumped online in no particular order. Among these FBI documents are a bunch of things called teletypes, which contain the original reports from individual agents in the field that the FBI then based its formal conclusions on. Trawling through these teletypes isn't much fun, and it can give you a fucking headache, but it can be worthwhile because there's always the chance that you'll find something in them that nobody has ever found before. As I looked through these FBI documents, I found three teletypes that deal with the cashing of Oswald's check. One of these was sent to J. Edgar Hoover from the Bureau's New Orleans office on December the 11th, 1963, and it says, quote, "Bank stamp of National Bank of Commerce at New Orleans reflects warrant received at that bank September 26th. The word warrant there means check. Specifically, it means the unemployment check that Oswald received in that final week of September. So what this teletype is saying is that a bank stamp proves that Oswald's check was deposited in the bank on Thursday, September the 26th. In other words, it says pretty much the same thing that Agent Donald Hughes said in that memo I just mentioned. And I think it's a fair bet that it was Agent Hughes himself who wrote or dictated this teletype. But there's another teletype in the FBI files that was sent from the New Orleans office 2 days earlier. And here's what that earlier teletype says about Oswald's unemployment check. Quote, "This check was included in deposit of Winn-Dixie store, but due to overlapping bank stamps, date of deposit cannot clearly be determined." This teletype is much more encouraging because if there were overlapping bank stamps on Oswald's check that made it impossible to determine the date it was deposited at the bank, then the possibility that Oswald cashed the check before 4 p.m. on Tuesday is back in play, and so is the possibility that he was in Dallas by 9 p.m. that night. But if the FBI found it impossible to decipher the overlapping bank stamps on Oswald's check on December the 9th, what made the Bureau change its mind just 2 days later and say that the bank stamp clearly showed a deposit date of September the 26th? Was there some other piece of independent evidence that resolved the confusion, or was the Bureau guilty of cutting corners again, as it so often was in this case? The honest answer is that at this distance, there's just no way of knowing. I've read a ton of books and articles about the Kennedy case, and I've never seen a single reference in the literature to the problem of the overlapping bank stamps, let alone any explanation of what made the FBI change its mind about this crucial piece of evidence. The FBI teletypes are all we have to go on, and they can be used to support whichever narrative you prefer. If you want to believe that Oswald wasn't at Sylvia Rodeo's apartment on Tuesday night, you can point to the second teletype. If you want to believe that he might have been there that night, you can point to the first teletype. But maybe we can break the deadlock by looking to an even earlier FBI teletype, which is dated November 28, 1963. This teletype says that Oswald's check was received at the bank, quote, "On a date which appears to be September 29, 1963, but is not completely legible due to overlapping bank stamps." At first glance, this teletype would seem to be useless. Whoever dictated it was clearly way off the mark, because there's no way the bank stamp could have said September 29. Oswald could only have cashed his check on Tuesday the 24th or Wednesday the 25th, meaning that the check could only have been received at the bank on either September 25th or September 26th. So the second numeral on the bank stamp couldn't possibly have been a 9, as this first FBI teletype tentatively suggested. It had to be either a 5 or a 6. But which of those numerals would look more like a 9 if it was half buried under a tangle of overlapping bank stamps? I'd say that a 5 could fairly easily be mistaken for a 9, but that a 6 absolutely couldn't be. In other words, I think the earlier FBI teletype tends to support the conclusion that Oswald's check was deposited at the bank on September the 25th, which means that he cashed it before 4 p.m. on the Tuesday, and therefore might well have been able to hit the road to Sylvia Odio's place that afternoon. Anyway, you can look at the overlapping bank stamps on Oswald's check for yourself if you want to. The Warren Commission published photostats of Oswald's cashed unemployment checks in Volume 22 of its exhibits. I'll include a link to the relevant page in the show notes on my website. The check I'm talking about is the middle one in the image. The front of the check is depicted on the left, and the back of the check, with the overlapping stamps on it, is pictured on the right. I've spent a long time looking at this image myself, and I would say that it's completely indecipherable. There seems to be a total of 4 overlapping stamps on the back of Oswald's check. It's a tangle of contending ink, and if you can work out how the FBI decided that they could clearly see the date of September the 26th in there, then your eyes are a lot better than mine. Personally, I can't make out anything in that thicket of ink that even vaguely looks like a 5 or a 6 or a 9, or indeed any other numeral. In other words, Oswald's final check strikes me as the very definition of an ambiguous piece of evidence. It's like a Rorschach ink blot. You can look at it for hours and see nothing. Or maybe if you're lucky, you can see what you want to see. In fact, the overlapping stamps on that check are a kind of metaphor for Kennedy research in general. If you're not careful, you can burrow so deeply into the evidence of this case that instead of getting sharper, the image starts to blur. You can find yourself moving beyond clarification and back into confusion. But if the evidence about the depositing of Oswald's check seems blurry, we can cut through the confusion by reminding ourselves that there was a very simple reason why we started to look at this evidence in the first place. We wanted to see if it rules out the possibility that Oswald went to Sylvia Odio's apartment. As I've said a few times now, Sylvia Odio's story is deeply compelling in itself, and we more or less have to believe that Oswald did go to her apartment unless there's other evidence that unambiguously shows that he couldn't have. Well, we've now looked at all the other evidence and we've seen that it doesn't unambiguously show that Oswald couldn't have gone to Sylvia Odio's apartment. The Twyford phone call isn't a strong enough piece of evidence to prove that the Odio incident didn't happen on Wednesday night, and the check evidence isn't clear enough to prove that the Odio incident couldn't have happened on Tuesday night. To prove that I'm not deluding myself about how weak the check evidence is, it's worth noting that the Warren Commission itself was never completely happy with its understanding of when and where Oswald cashed his final check. You wouldn't know this from reading the Warren report itself, because the report makes it sound as if the check evidence was cut and dried and proved beyond any doubt that Oswald was still in New Orleans on Wednesday morning. But some of the Commission's more alert investigators could see that the report's explanation of the check evidence didn't make a great deal of sense. The report tells you that Oswald collected his check from the post office on the Wednesday morning, cashed it at the Winn-Dixie store on Magazine Street that same morning, and then caught the Trailways bus to Houston at 12:20 that afternoon. But the post office and the bus station were in downtown New Orleans, whereas the Winn-Dixie store was way back near Oswald's apartment, about 2 miles from the downtown area. Given that Oswald had already cleared out of his apartment and dropped his suitcases at the bus station and had no apparent reason to return to his old neighbourhood, why would he have picked up his check at the post office downtown and then gone all the way back to his local supermarket to cash it and then come all the way back downtown to catch his bus to Houston when he could easily have cashed his check somewhere in the downtown area? The commission knew that Oswald had previously cashed some of his checks at a place called Martin's Restaurant, which was close to the post office and bus station. So why didn't he cash his final unemployment check there too, instead of making a 4-mile round trip back to the Winn-Dixie? Less than a month before the Warren Report was submitted, the commission was still trying to solve this little mystery. Its chief counsel, J. Lee Rankin, wrote a letter to J. Edgar Hoover. I'll read out a quote from that letter. It's a fairly long quote, but it's worth hearing in full. Quote, "It is a matter of some importance to the Commission that Mrs. Odio's allegations either be proved or disproved. We are also concerned about the possibility that Oswald may have left New Orleans on Tuesday, September the 24th, 1963, instead of Wednesday, September the 25th, 1963. In that connection, Marina Oswald has recently advised us that her husband told her that he intended to leave New Orleans the very next day following her departure on September the 23rd. It also seems improbable to us that Oswald would have gone all the way back to the Winn-Dixie store at 4303 Magazine Street to cash the check, which he supposedly picked up at the Lafayette branch of the post office when he could have cashed it at Martin's Restaurant, where he had previously cashed many of his Riley checks and won an employment check. This is particularly true if he had received the check on September the 25th, as previously thought, and had left his apartment with his suitcases the evening before." End quote. It's pretty interesting that Rankin uses the phrase "as previously thought" when he refers to the belief that Oswald received his check on the Wednesday. Clearly, the commission was still prepared to rethink this belief, even at this very late stage of its investigation. As Rankin's letter implies, the fact that Oswald cashed his check at the Winn-Dixie store does make slightly more sense if you assume that he received the check on Tuesday rather than Wednesday. Above all, what Rankin's letter to Hoover shows us is that on August the 28th, less than a month before the Warren Report was submitted, the Commission still had an open mind about the Odio incident and the check evidence and the date of Oswald's departure from New Orleans. The Commission was still trying to get some genuine closure on these questions, and it was making a good faith appeal for J. Edgar Hoover's help. Sadly, though, the Commission's attempt to pursue these questions was short-circuited when Hoover hoodwinked them with his bullshit story about Lauren Hall, which I discussed in the previous episode. At the 11th hour, Hoover falsely told the Commission that the three men who'd visited Sylvia Odio's apartment had been identified, and that their names were Lauren Hall, William Seymour, and Lawrence Howard. The Warren Commission accepted Hoover's claim at face value, and you can hardly blame it for doing so. You can hardly blame the Commission for failing to guess that the director of the FBI was lying to them. And because the Commission believed Hoover's story, it closed down its investigation of the Odio incident, and our best chance to understand the truth of what really happened was blown forever. When the House Select Committee on Assassinations reinvestigated the Odio incident in 1977, it found that, quote, "There is no doubt that three men came to Sylvia Odio's apartment in Dallas prior to the Kennedy assassination and identified themselves as members of an anti-Castro organization, and it must be concluded that there is a strong probability that one of the men was, or appeared to be, Lee Harvey Oswald." But the House Select Committee couldn't work out for sure if that man was Oswald, and it could reach no firm conclusion about the incident's meaning or significance, because 14 years after the event, all the best evidence had gone cold. As the committee's report put it, quote, The lack of immediate recognition of the significance of the ODO incident produced a far from comprehensive investigation at the only time when a comprehensive and perhaps fruitful investigation would have been possible. If all the best leads about the ODO incident had already gone cold by 1977, imagine how ice cold they are now. Whoever the three men were who visited Sylvia ODO that night, chances are that they're now all dead. And if they are, they went to their graves without ever coming forward to tell their side of the story. It now seems almost certain that we'll never know who those men were or what they were playing at. We'll never know for sure if the American man with them was indeed Lee Harvey Oswald, and if he was, we'll never know if he said anything else to those men about shooting President Kennedy. Maybe Oswald did say something more concrete about shooting Kennedy to the other two men. Maybe that's why they never came forward after Kennedy's death. In the end, all we can do is speculate, because what we know about the ODO incident seems to be only a fragment of the full story. All we have is a tantalizing piece of a larger puzzle, and there's no way of knowing how many other pieces of the puzzle are missing and how big those pieces are. If we knew the whole story of the ODO incident, it might even cause us to revise our basic understanding of the Kennedy assassination, but the whole story seems destined to elude us. This means that any conclusions we reach about the ODO incident can only be tentative and might well be wrong. But for what it's worth, my own feeling is that the story told by Sylvia and Annie ODO was 100% accurate. I think Lee Harvey Oswald did visit their apartment in the last week of September 1963. As for which night he was there, I think the Wednesday night was possible, but I think the Tuesday night fits the evidence better. I think Oswald wrapped up his activities in New Orleans by 1 p.m. on Wednesday, drove to Dallas with his two Cuban amigos, and arrived on Sylvia ODO's doorstep by about 9 p.m. The next day, he made his way to Houston, and he was in town by early evening when he placed that local phone call to Mrs. Twyford in the hope of being able to kill the next few hours by shooting the breeze with her husband Horace. But if the ODO incident did occur, then what did it mean? It isn't hard to guess what it probably meant from Oswald's angle. On the eve of his big trip to the Cuban embassy, Oswald was making one last attempt to infiltrate an anti-Castro organization and to gather intelligence on Castro's enemies in America. He'd done this sort of thing before, but this time he pushed the envelope in a new direction by introducing the idea that President Kennedy should be shot. Why he said that is a fascinating question, but one likely explanation is that he said it in an attempt to make the anti-Castro men say something similarly rash about assassinating Castro, so that Oswald could then pass that information on to Fidel when he went to Cuba. So although we'll never know for sure what Oswald thought he was playing at on Sylvia ODO's doorstep, that does seem like a reasonable guess. But even if that guess is right, it only solves part of the ODO mystery. We're still left with the question of the other two men and what they were up to. It does seem pretty clear that they were up to something, and that, like Oswald, they too were not who they claimed to be. The day after they turned up at her apartment, the man who called himself Leopoldo placed that follow-up phone call to Sylvia ODO. He told her that he and his friends were heading off on a trip and that they would, quote, very much like to see her again when they returned to Dallas. But that promised return visit never ended up happening. In fact, Sylvia ODO never heard from these men again. They seem to have been phantoms. After that phone call, they vanished from the radar forever. In fact, it turned out that they had never been on anybody's radar to begin with. Nobody in the real anti-Castro underground in New Orleans or Dallas knew any men who used the war names Leopoldo or Angelo or fit these men's physical description. And when Sylvia wrote to her father to ask him if he knew these men, He emphatically replied that he didn't. He wrote, "Please tell me again who it is that calls himself my friend. Be careful. I do not have any friends that have been near me lately, even in Dallas. You are very alone with no man to protect you, and you can be easily fooled." End quote. So there seems to be no doubt that Leopoldo and Angelo lied to Silvia Odio. They weren't really members of the anti-Castro underground. They weren't really friends of her father. And yet, as Silvia said, they did appear to be scarily well informed about her father's activities. They knew what his underground code name was, and they correctly used her mother's code name as well. As Silvia told the Warren Commission, Leopoldo, quote, "gave me so many details about where they saw my father and what activities he was in. I mean, they gave me almost incredible details about things that somebody who knows him really would, or that somebody informed well knows." So who were Leopoldo and Angelo really? The fact that they never did come forward after Kennedy's assassination seems instructive. If they had nothing to hide, if they were simple anti-Castro activists who had been hoodwinked by Oswald, they would have had an interesting story to tell, and they could have got rich and famous by telling it. The fact that they never came forward suggests that they did have something to hide, and that they were quite definitely up to no good when they came to Silvia Odio's house. One possibility is that they were agents of Fidel Castro, and were posing as anti-Castro men in order to extract information from Silvia Odio about the activities of Castro's enemies in America. In the cloak-and-dagger world of Cuban exile politics, that scenario was definitely possible. But if these men had set out to fool Silvia Odio, they must have known that they wouldn't fool her for very long. They would have known that when she asked around, she would discover that they weren't really members of the anti-Castro underground. So whatever they wanted out of Silvia Odio, they must have hoped they would get it from her straight away before their cover was blown. Jean Davidson makes this point very astutely in her book Oswald's Game, and she has a useful theory about the information that these men might have been after. She writes, quote, "What did they want from Mrs. Odio? Apparently, they hoped she would know and tell them the name of the right person to see, the leader behind these new assassination plots against Castro. The underlying logic seemed to be, we know about your father's connection with a terrorist plot to kill Castro. We believe you have contacts with the underground. Here is an American you can use." End quote. I find Davidson's theory pretty persuasive. Just a couple of weeks before the Odio incident, American newspapers had indeed reported that Fidel Castro believed that Cuban terrorists, aided by the US government, were plotting to assassinate him. Maybe Leopoldo and Angelo thought Silvia Odio would know who was running these assassination plots and would let them in on the details. This interpretation would still make sense if they really were anti-Castro men, as they claimed to be, and if they wanted to get in on the Castro assassination themselves, but it would make even more sense if they were secret agents of the Castro regime and wanted to penetrate the assassination plots so they could pass on the details to Castro. If these men did want to get this kind of information out of Silvia Odio, they failed to get it out of her that night at her apartment. This would explain why Leopoldo placed that apparently superfluous phone call to Silvia the next day. He knew that his window of opportunity was closing fast, because the previous night, just before she shooed them off her doorstep, Silvia Odio had told them, quote, "I am going to write to my father and tell him that you have come to visit me." This remark would have been a bummer for Leopoldo and Angelo. They would have known that Silvia's father would tell her that they were imposters and that she should have nothing to do with them. The jig would be up as soon as her father replied to her, so Leopoldo phoned Silvia while his cover story was still intact, and he made one last-ditch attempt to get the information that he'd failed to get out of her the previous night. This time, he upped the ante by telling her that Oswald had talked about shooting President Kennedy. Maybe he hoped that If he told Sylvia that Oswald was a capable and eager marksman, she would then spill the beans about the details of the Castro assassination plot. But she didn't, and she probably knew nothing about it anyway. And after that final phone call, Leopoldo apparently gave up on her. If Leopoldo and Angelo were pro-Castro spies, though, that raises the crucial question of whether Oswald knew that. Was he aware that the other two men were secretly on Castro's side? And if he was, were they aware that he was secretly on Castro's side too? If the men were in the dark about each other's true agendas, that would put us into hilarious territory. That would mean that Oswald, a pro-Castro man posing as an anti-Castro man, had penetrated an ostensibly anti-Castro organisation that was really a pro-Castro organisation, so that while he thought he was fooling and manipulating the other two men, they thought they were fooling and manipulating him, and they were really all on the same side without knowing it. But what if Oswald and the other two men were not only on the same side, but knew they were on the same side? Suddenly you would have a situation that's no longer so comical, because if Oswald and those other two men were involved in a pro-Castro conspiracy to fool Sylvia Odio, maybe they were also involved in a pro-Castro conspiracy to murder President Kennedy. Maybe the two mysterious Cubans convinced Oswald that killing Kennedy would be a pro-Castro act. Maybe they promised him that if he shot the president, they would help him escape to Cuba afterwards. As long as the Odio incident remains unexplained, these possibilities can't be completely ruled out. And unfortunately, the Odio incident seems destined to remain unexplained forever. It's the ghost in the machine of the Kennedy assassination. It's the one piece of evidence that makes me wonder if maybe there was some kind of conspiracy behind Kennedy's murder. Mind you, it should be clear what kind of conspiracy I'm talking about there. I'm not talking about an absurd Oliver Stone-style conspiracy in which somebody went around posing as Oswald before the assassination in order to frame him. I'm talking about a limited, small-scale conspiracy in which Oswald was willingly involved. We know that that's the only sort of conspiracy there could have been in this case, because we know beyond any doubt that Oswald fired the shots that killed Kennedy. We also know enough about Oswald's life to be able to say that it's highly unlikely that he conspired with other people, because Oswald simply had almost no friends or associates or contacts that he could feasibly have conspired with. But the Odio incident requires us to put a small asterisk next to that statement, because the Odio incident puts Oswald in the company of two unknown men just 2 months before the assassination. Because we still don't know who these men were and what became of them and what their true agenda was, we're just not in a position to be able to say for sure that Oswald couldn't have conspired with them to kill Kennedy. As I was putting together my thoughts about the Odio incident, I remembered something that an old friend of mine used to say. He used to say, "You've got to learn to live with ambiguity." When the evidence about something is ambiguous or inconclusive, there's nothing wrong with admitting that. Where people go wrong in the Kennedy case is when they become sure of things they've got no right to be sure of because those things have never been proved. When that happens, you end up with bad books and cruddy documentaries, and at worst, you can end up accusing innocent people of doing things they didn't really do. That's what happened in 1969, when a New Orleans district attorney named Jim Garrison prosecuted a man named Clay Shaw for conspiring in the murder of John F. Kennedy. To this day, the trial of Clay Shaw is the only time that any person has ever been criminally prosecuted in association with Kennedy's murder. The trial of Clay Shaw was a shameful fiasco, and it destroyed the life of an innocent man. And that's the story I'll be telling next time on The Ghosts of Dallas.
Are you willing to say tonight, when your trial comes up, that you'll secure a conviction without the shadow of a doubt?
I cannot make a statement which would reflect on Mr. Shaw. Since the day I We charged him and arrested him. I have not made a statement which inferred that he's guilty, and I cannot infer that now. But I am trying to tell you that there is no question as a result of our investigation that an element of the Central Intelligence Agency of our country killed John Kennedy, and that the present administration is concealing the facts. There is no question about it at all.
That is your opinion.
No, it is not. I know it, and if you will just wait, you will see that history will support this as fact.